penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I now taste the truth of that Tathagata's words.
No, you can sit in the chair.
If it's warmer back there, sit back there, but it's
warmer.
I felt last week that I was, can I talk now? Well, I don't know if you had this thing, you know, hooked up or whatever. And I felt last week that I said some things that maybe seem a little bit radical about the imagination, especially in the context of this Zen tradition. And in fact, I sort of made that comment that this may not be very Zen to be saying these things. And then circuitously it came back to me that some people thought that I was kind of out of line from the point of view of what's authentic spiritual practice. Part of what this was about was that I hadn't made completely clear that I'm not talking about just ordinary fantasy, that in fact I was talking about using one's imagination within the context of already having attended to the basics of middle way Buddhist thought, and that those basics in fact form the substratum or the themes, in fact, or the specifics of how to practice in the kitchen, for example, grew out of. So I've been thinking that this needs to be clarified and exemplified more specifically. So I thought what I would do this evening is go back to some of the themes that I was starting to work with last week, but do them in a very specific philosophical context to see how these things actually do fit together, the abstraction of middle way philosophy and the practicality of cutting carrots and thinking about the garden or whatever. But I want to preface that with a passage from Dogen so I can really be on the safe side, from Refining Your Life, which is a translation of How to Practice in the Zen Kitchen. I guess the Japanese is, if I can find it. Tenzo Kyokan. So this is at the very end. I'll read you the whole passage, because clearly what I'm going to say is out of context, but not out of tradition. First I have to look up a footnote, though. Magnanimous mind is like a mountain, stable and impartial. Exemplifying the ocean, it is tolerant and views everything from the broadest perspective. Having a magnanimous mind means being without prejudice and refusing to take sides. When carrying something that weighs an ounce, do not think of it as light. And likewise, when you have to carry 50 pounds, do not think of it as heavy. Do not get carried away by the sounds of spring, nor become heavy-hearted upon seeing the colors of fall. View the changes of the seasons as a whole, and weigh the relativeness of light and heavy from a broad perspective. It is then that you should write, understand, and study the character for magnanimous. Now, the reason I was drawn to this passage was, it's my view that although he says, when you carry 2 ounces, carry it like 2 ounces, and when you carry 50 pounds, carry it like 50 pounds, don't think of it as heavy, and don't think of the other former as light. At the same time, he is advocating a broader view of how things fit together, which in fact requires, if you pardon the word, imaginativeness.
because how can you view the changes of the season as a whole without using your imagination? Because when it's winter, the only way you can view all the other three seasons is with memory and imagination. In order to view the seasons as a whole, you can't merely be in the here and now. You have to be in the here and now, in which the here and now of one season is connected to the here and now, or the there and then, of the other seasons. Or else, in fact, you can't view the seasons as a whole. I said I wasn't going to take questions, but I will. Once.
What do you mean, like, experiencing winter as winter in wholeness?
Of winter?
Of winter.
Well, it could. You know, I'm not a Dogen expert, and I certainly have no idea what the actual Japanese says, but he does say view the changes of the seasons as a whole. So that's what led me to that conclusion. So, you know, I don't want to misquote him, but he says, again, with the translation, says, weigh the relativeness of light and heavy from a broad perspective. Again, it's the same thing. Somehow, seeing the relationship of light and heavy requires a broadness of mind which extends beyond just the heaviness of the situation and the lightness of the situation. And it's interesting that this advice, interesting to me, that this advice follows the carry a 50-pound sack as 50 pounds and don't think of it as heavy. And yet he is, directly after that, saying, weigh that relativeness of light and heavy from a broad perspective. Somehow that requires having a sense of what means light when you're carrying heavy, even though heavy is still heavy, I would think. That's my interpretation. So that sort of prologues the class. Because the real... I'm not a Dogen expert, so I certainly get in trouble. So the basis upon which I really want to sort of establish the method that I'm proposing here is upon Nagarjuna, because at least I'm a Nagarjuna expert, so I'm only relatively getting into trouble. So not everybody knows who Nagarjuna is, so let me give a brief sort of background. For those of you who are traditionalists, Nagarjuna is one of the ancestors whose names are chanted in the Zendo every day. And in this tradition, he's called
Nagaharjuna,
something like that. Yeah. Nagaharjuna. Anyhow, that's Nagarjuna, as the name eventually made it into Japanese. And Nagarjuna is basically the systematizer or clarifier of the entire Mahayana wisdom tradition, and the source, in fact, of many of the great sutras that influenced East Asia, such as, besides the Perfection of Wisdom sutras, such as, I believe, the Lotus Sutra is one of the ones that he discovered in the Naga Palace, bottom of the ocean. But he's a great philosopher, and the whole of Mahayana Buddhist thought rests on formulations clarified or established by him. So he is actually to Buddhist thought what Plato is to Western thought. And his disciple Aryadeva is as Aristotle is to Western thought. But he's not like Aristotle anymore, they're not regarded as like Plato. But the point of view of their position in the unfoldment of Asian philosophy is at least compatible. And in fact, one could probably argue that Nagarjuna is even more central than Plato or Aristotle, because he's influenced the entirety of the East Asian tradition, the South Asian tradition. And in fact, probably has influenced considerably Hindu thought, too, although Hindus would certainly say that's bullshit. It's probably not true. Because I think it's true.
Okay. So I'm going to read you two stanzas from a text that I translated. It's one of his five or six fundamental texts.
What?
Okay, two brown stars, one for each of you. This is out of the 70 stanzas on emptiness, or the emptiness 70, the Shunyata Saptati, written probably in the 2nd, 3rd century A.D., sometime around then, in probably in northeast India, maybe at University of Nalanda. That's not clear. And that's one of his fundamental philosophical texts. So it's incredibly tight. And it'll take us a little while to unravel what these two stanzas mean. But I'll use them as the basis for the rest of this class. So let's take a little time to unravel them anyhow. Well, there's stanzas 29 and 30. And in my text, in the uncommented section there on page 86, in the commented section, well, you just look it up.
Could you say what year it was written again?
2nd or 3rd century A.D. Sometime around then. I mean, we can't be too precise about these things. The commentary, the stanzas 29 and 30, is found on page 140, 141, 142, and half of 143. Sure. All right, so here are the stanza. I'll read the two stanzas and all but the last part of the 30th stanza, and then deconstruct it for you, or unpack it, or do something to it. And then this really will lead into everyday emptiness, maybe even today. Time does not exist inherently, because the three periods of time do not maintain continuity by themselves, but are dependent on each other. If the three times were to have inherent existence in a mutually dependent way, then we could not make distinctions between them. But because we can make distinctions, so time itself cannot be established as having inherent existence. Because time does not have inherent existence, the functional basis on which the three times is imputed cannot have inherent existence. So therefore, the three times do not have inherent existence and are merely imputed by concepts. That's the 29th stanza. 30th says, following the reasoning just given, the three characteristics of a composite phenomenon, which are arising, enduring, and ceasing, are unfindable upon ultimate analysis, even for you. There's an argument going on here. So this is the person that's arguing with him. So then, a functional phenomenon, which is characterized by these three attributes, is also unfindable, in which case the functional basis of a composite phenomenon becomes unfindable. Now that sounds like a big mouthful. Let's try and figure out what this means and why this is actually pertinent, just a little piece at a time. And I'm sort of going to do some of this backwards. First off, he makes a distinction here between what he calls the functional basis upon which time is imputed and time. So let's start with that.
Functional.
I don't know what the word imputed means.
I'm going to explain the whole, every piece of it, so not to be concerned. First off, we all have in our minds an idea that there is time. And you say, I get into this because when I was talking about cutting potatoes or carrots or whatever, I got into talking about the past, how the carrots got into the kitchen, and where they're going, turning into meditators in the future, coming from the garden in the past.
Meditators.
Potatoes, meditators. So this is what's called the three moments of time, traditionally in Buddhism, which is the past, present, and future. There's nothing very exotic or esoteric about that. Although it can be understood in a slightly more sophisticated way than that, which is how do we actually experience time, rather than what are our concepts about time, which is an entirely other matter than what's going on. In other words, we have some ideas about time, and we have some experiences of time, but to what do those things refer, those ideas or those experiences? To what does the past refer? To what does the future refer? To what does the present refer? When we first sort of look at this idea of past, present, and future, we say, oh, well, that's true. It refers to time. But when we wonder what is time, if we actually push at what is our experience that generates the concept of time, that makes the concept time have meaning, I think most people come to the conclusion that what their actual experience is the experience of change, or what's called in this kind of tradition, arising, enduring, and ceasing. In other words, what we call the past is that which has ceased, an experience or set of experiences that we've had which are no longer happening, or something that we perceive to exist which no longer exists. It has ceased. It has faded away in some, for some reason. So cessation is what we experience, and we call that past when we're referring to time. Again, sort of the experiential basis upon which we develop the idea of future is what's called arising, which is to say that which was not now comes to be. It arises from not being into being. That the future comes toward us and becomes the present, and things arise. So the child that did not exist and is born, in a sense we could say, arises. Or the sprout that germinates, comes out from the seed, arises. At one moment it was not, and then it comes toward us. It arises, it comes to be. And what's called enduring is, in fact, our more or less experience of the moment, where we see things as being just right there in this particular way. It endures. In fact, the whole way we experience phenomena is that they don't change, which is why there's such a big teaching in Buddhism about impermanence, because there's something problematic in the way we experience things, because we experience everything as enduring, 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 and not as ceasing, and not as arising. So these three things coming together are what we call change, because that which endures, we do experience as going through transformation. We do experience, if we say the thing itself doesn't change, or excuse me, if we say the thing itself doesn't arise or newly arise, we say new characteristics of it arise, and old characteristics fade away. For example, we experience ourselves as basically permanent, but getting older with the same person. So new characteristics arise, like baldness, larger waistlines. Older characteristics cease, like vitality, or clear eyes, or things like that. I didn't hear you. What?
He's leaving. Your hearing starts to dim.
Yeah, my hearing is definitely dim. Okay, so you get the idea. So this is sort of the straight Buddhist language. I mean, that's all this is Buddhist language. But the point that Nagarjuna is making here with this concept of imputing is a little bit different. The word impute is probably, although it's a good word, maybe a little confusing. We probably would be safer in some respect to use the word project, which is to say that certain characteristics that objects or phenomena have, we say we project onto them, like their permanence and their unchanging nature, which aren't actually there. The word that's technically, a technical word, is to impute the quality onto that. For example, it's very hard to look at a gold ring with a very large diamond on it and simply see a piece of metal and a piece of stone that glistens. Because if we look at a gold ring with a very large diamond on it, we see something more than just a stone and a piece of metal. We see something called wealth, attractiveness, frustration, aversion. All those things are actually there in the experience of that thing in that moment. And we see value in the diamond. The diamond itself has no value. It's just full of carbon that's been chipped, you know, squeezed and chipped. But we see value in it. It's actually, in our own experience, probably impossible not to see it as having that. Okay. So those qualities are imputed to it by our own minds. Now, here the point that Nagarjuna is trying to make is that we impute the existence of time and we impute change onto the phenomena in our experience. The way he says it. Therefore, the three times do not have inherent existence and are merely imputed by concepts. So without getting into it at the moment, what is inherent existence? It says, therefore, the three times in regards to objects or the functional basis by which the three times is imputed. Okay, I'll do the whole sentence. Because time does not have inherent existence, or because time is empty, or because time is unsubstantial in some way. That's a short gloss on inherent existence. Because time does not have inherent existence, the functional basis on which the three times is imputed cannot have inherent existence. The functional basis is the supposed actual phenomenon which appears to change over time. Okay. That's the basis upon which we project the concept of time. It's the screen upon which we run the movie of change. You following this? Mm-mm. I don't feel like we're following. Are we following this?
Yes.
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 Yes, no.
Somewhat.
Yes. Somewhat.
I would like to hear it again.
Okay, let's see if I can find an example.
Actually, did you just say it again?
Well, I'll read the whole sentence again. Because time does not exist, because time does not have inherent existence, the functional basis on which the three times is imputed cannot have inherent existence. So therefore, the three times do not have inherent existence and are merely imputed by concepts. It's not the inherent existence stuff that I'm so concerned about at the moment. It's the imputed by concepts. The three times are merely imputed on a functional basis by our concepts. The three times are arising, enduring, and ceasing, or if you'd like, past, present, and future. And the past, present, and future of an object, or its arising, enduring, and ceasing, he is saying, right, those qualities, those aspects, are created by our own minds and projected and seen in all the objects that we encounter. Okay. The functional basis is the screen upon which the movie is projected, I said. That means to say that there is a world and then there is our ideas. And in our experience, our ideas and the world come together in a way in which we seem not able to separate them. Reb talks about this when he talks about in every moment of experience, mind and objects are so intricately entangled as to really not be able to be separated. Here he's talking about what appear to be subject and object. Object, the kind of thing that he's talking about as presumed object, is here what's called functional basis, the basis for imputation, the basis for having fantasies. Okay. In the case of the diamond ring, you could say that the functional basis upon which value is imputed is a metal called gold and a stone called diamond. Was that clarified at all? Yeah.
And this word functional basis, that sounds like it's a fancy term, we could just say basis upon which it's imputed. He says functional for a specific reason, which also doesn't need to concern us, but it has to do with the fact that it can be a cause for an effect.
So you're saying that the ring is designed to give the illusion of wealth, and that it's purely as the ring has been designed for
that. Not only that, not only has the ring been designed for that.
Well, it's beauty.
That's correct. Not only has the ring been designed to give the impression of wealth, but in fact, the only reason, for example, the diamonds are viewed as something representing wealth or something that's expensive is because of a mass fantasy that diamonds are rare and beautiful and therefore worthy of being sought after, and one would expend a lot of effort for them. In fact, and I wasn't thinking of this when I picked the example, but in fact, there's so many diamonds in the world that the diamond companies have to control the production and sale of diamonds and advertise extensively how important it is to give diamonds, you know, when you get engaged, when you get married, when you have a 50th anniversary, what have you, in order to artificially create a need for something, which is actually quite common.
So that's the sentence, merely imputed by concepts.
Mm-hmm. Merely imputed by concepts is like Madison Avenue. Right, that's a good example. Madison Avenue is all about merely imputing by concept the value of things that are otherwise valueless. You know, like why is a Buick more valuable than a Chevy? Or a Cadillac more valuable than a Buick? I mean, what is that?
Isn't there something about the most permanent, impermanent?
Well, I don't know whether that's true or not, but it doesn't have anything to do with its value. Its permanence has nothing to do with its value. Its value has to do with a collective fantasy.
But it's permanent.
It's true, too. It has an intrinsic merit because it lasts longer than anything else.
That may be, but that's not the kind of
joke. Yeah, I know.
The symbol of durability.
Yeah, I mean, let's not get hung up on the metaphor. You know? I mean, let's sort of cut to what the metaphor is about. What the metaphor is about is about the difference between what is and our thoughts about what is. And that in our experience, the two are entangled in such a way as, for us most of the time, not to be separable. Yes,
Jim. It was just interesting, you know, what I wasn't sure whether Zoe or Pam said it, but it has to do with its hardness and permanence being part of its intrinsic value. And I think that's the very point. It's not intrinsic. Mm. That's a conceptual overlay.
It's not a concept. It's a practical use. I mean, I've been thinking about what you're saying for the last 10 minutes. The whole idea of a diamond being empty of what we project onto it as value, to me, it's the wealth that's empty. It's not the diamond having what we... Because if all 5 billion of us get together and say, this is of value to us, we make it of value. It's like a dollar bill. You know,
that's right.
It is of value. We make it value. It's not in nature of value.
The value isn't in it.
We give the value to it, yes.
Yeah, the value is in our minds, not in the diamond.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the hardness of the diamond has nothing to do with its value. Because actually... Mm-hmm. That's not what makes it valuable. Not its hardness that makes it valuable. It's supposed rarity and beauty that makes it valuable. You can say the same thing for gold. Maybe that's a better example.
Could you use time as an example?
What?
Could you use time as an example?
Well, that was where we started from, actually. Time, which is we experience something around us called change. And when we analyze what that experience is, it has three aspects. And if we look at those three aspects, we find that we can make a distinction, a clear analytic distinction in our minds between a thing and its changing, or its aspects of change. we can make a distinction between the thing, its arising, its enduring, and its ceasing. In other words, we can abstract the notion of enduring. We can abstract the notion of arising. We can abstract the notion of ceasing. And out of those three abstractions, we make a further abstraction called time, which we then perceive as going on all around us. But you see, the point that I'm trying to make, and that Nagarjuna is trying to make, at least at this level, is those are three different things right there. Phenomenon, the three moments of time, and the idea of time, each of which is a further abstraction of the previous. Okay. And, more significantly, they all depend on each other. Right? Each is imputed upon the basis of the other. Now, Nagarjuna further makes the point, and this is more actually what I was trying to get to in this, is that it's actually for us not possible to experience or know what means arising except in relationship to enduring or ceasing. Nor can we understand what means enduring except in relationship to arising and ceasing. Nor can we know what means ceasing except in relationship to arising and enduring. So you think about it for a moment. Think about the sprout which has emerged from the mung bean seed, if you will. If we see the sprout in the moment now, okay, in our minds we know that there was a time when the sprout was not. There was a time before it was here. Okay, and then it came about. Now, we also know that there will be a time when it no longer exists. We have this kind of concept. But how do we know what is the future except in relationship to the now? The future is what has not yet happened, right? How else do we define the future? So it has not yet happened. It requires us to think about what has happened and then to define what's not happened in terms of what has happened now. Okay. And how do we know the past except that it's what once had happened but is no longer happening? So the past is defined in relationship to the now also. Now, how do we define the now? Anyone want to take a stab at defining the now?
Sensory experience.
It's our sensory experience, but that doesn't make it now, but that makes it experience. It doesn't say anything about defining now.
Is the now fully experiencing a changing moment?
Well, what is a changing moment?
Well, it seems to me that the past and the future are extreme views of change. The now is the most subtle this way. The past is like we put this big block, the past, and a lot of things happened in the past, and we know it happened, and it's da 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 da. Then the future is like we put a lot of projections in the future, say, you know that a tree sheds its, a flower blooms, sheds its seeds, and dies. So the seed is actually part of the cessation of the flower, and yet it's the arising of it. Do you understand? So it's like the past is like the emphasis on this big movement going on with the flower dying. And the future is what the seed is going to grow into.
Okay.
So the right now is this very fine, subtle, like just moving.
Which is not the future nor the past, is the way you define the now.
Yeah, because you must slow everything down slowly. Right. Yeah.
So in that way, your definition of the present is dependent upon a future and a past.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the problem with that is that your definition of the future and the past is dependent upon the present. So the point is that you're in a tautology, which is to say that the three mutually define each other, as Nagarjuna says, that future, present, and past are actually only experienceable as such in relationship to each other. They actually have no meaning outside of relationship to each other. What we call present is, as you say, sensory experience. But what we call present in order to say it is now, we have to understand now as being other than them. We don't get a now except in relationship to a then or a will be. In other words, a not past or a not future. We don't get a past except in relationship to a now. It's not now. It's gone away. And we don't get a future except in relationship to a now and a past, which is to say it hasn't happened yet. But in the future, it will be now, then. So we've got to have a now or then. You see what I'm saying? So this is not mere play on words. This is how our minds work. And if this were trivial, then that would be okay. Except for the fact that all of our lives are emotionally organized around the issue of that which is ceased and that which is yet to be, and ambivalence and ambiguity about that which currently is. And yet, our thoughts about these things are all predicated on each other in unbelievably interconnected and complicated ways. Okay? And on top of all of that, if that were enough, that this tautology, right, is self-arising and self-dependent and self-defining, the three aspects of it, it's all based upon projection onto a basis which is other than the abstraction that's exercising our minds, that we impute future, present, and past onto a world. And yet in that world, can we find future, present, and past? We know we can't find future because it hasn't happened yet. We know we can't find past because it's already ceased to exist. So we say, okay, at least I can find present in the here and now, right? So then if we go looking for it, I will stake my life, you can't find it, right? I will defy you to be able to find the present in any given moment when you go looking for it. You may find what appears to be something, but you won't find any present in that something. Okay. I think we're all together on this point now.
This is the diving board where you drop into nihilism or not nihilism.
No. It's a diving board where you drop into recognizing that mind is completely entangled in so-called objective experience. So that objective experience isn't actually objective. That objective experience is merely experience of mind, presumably, entangled with object, presumably. Except we also know, as Reb has been eloquent, we can't even disentangle mind and object. It's actually impossible to disentangle mind and object because every object we experience is experience, which is to say, we can't separate the two, because if there's object without experiencing it, there's no object for you. Right.
So you could call it about the function of experience?
You're using Nagarjuna's language?
What you just said, it's like we have to experience something, or we have to have object just so that we can function.
Well, what I was trying to say was not quite that. What I was trying to say is, in our experience, we can't ever get to where we can separate object from subject or mind from experience. In other words, we can't separate the functional basis from that which is doing the imputing. They just arise together with these presumed characteristics of past, present, and future. Now, why does all of this stuff matter, right? Why did I get into all of this? Okay. I got into all of this because of this issue of being in the kitchen and cutting carrots. Because I had said last week that when you're in the kitchen cutting carrots, one thing that you can do is you can have this fantasy, or you can use your imagination to bring the future and the present and the past moments of the life of that carrot and your relationship all together in the present. I said you have to do that. Because you use your imagination to see the sangha that's eating the soup. But you can use your imagination to see the garden crew aspect of the sangha producing the carrots and bringing it to the kitchen. And so there's some question about, well, but that's all fantasy, isn't it? And then I quoted my Lama, Taratoku, who said, well, yes, that's true. It's all fantasy, but the whole world we live in is a world we've made up, a world of fantasy. So let's use some fantasies that are positive for a change. So the point of investigating time in this way is to see that, in fact, the whole world we live in, that we see as time-bound, having past, present, and future, that we see phenomena as arising, enduring, and ceasing, is a big fantasy in itself, right? Because we can't find any of those things anyplace. I mean, it's the ultimate fantasy, right? You can't find time. You can't find past, present, and future. You can't find subject, and you can't find object. If those things aren't fantasies, I don't know what they are. So if those things are fantasies, how are they any more a fantasy than the fantasy of seeing Leon tending the compost pile that becomes the carrots that end up on the cutting board in the kitchen in front of me? How is one of those things more a fantasy than another? Is my point. It's not. Because what is it in me that doesn't see Leon in the carrot in the first place? That means, that causes me to have to perform the exercise of fantasizing Leon turning garbage into compost and compost into carrots. Why is it that I don't see that right off, that I have to fantasize that? Well, that's a $64,000 question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Maybe because you haven't done the meal chant often enough. I think after the meal chant, it was hard to, you know, where it says we should know how this food comes to us. I sort of sat down and saw it growing before I ate it. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the meal chant. That's good. Let's talk about the meal chant. We should know how this food comes to us. What does that mean? We should know how this food comes to us.
It's truly fantasizing about what are all these interconnections that brought this here. I mean, you know, looking at the table and like, where does the table come from, and what Thich Nhat Hanh does, you know, you see food and you see a forest and you see a lumberjack and mm-hmm. and it's and fantasizing about all of that. And what makes up this world and all the webs.
It's almost like you couldn't exist or function without everything else.
That's right. That's right. It's called dependent arising or interconnections or something else like that. So what's the point of that? What's the point of seeing that? What's the point of
it? Because we usually think that we do exist.
That's right.
And realizing that we are not like the present, which is present, separated from each other too, but that we are only here in connection to.
That's right.
All these other things.
That's right. So one aspect of this supposed circumstance we find ourselves in, being isolated or independent or separate, is that all that stuff that happened in the past is not affecting us in the present. The past is what's gone. No longer exists. It has no connection to us. Now, as long as we believe such a thing and believe about, say, about the future, then everything that happens in the present moment is encapsulated, separated from, independent of all of those aspects. So there's no lumberjack in the table. There's no Leon in the carrot. Now, the implication of, I don't mean to pick on you, Leon, but you're here. the implication, I mean, and you're less abstract than a lumberjack. the implication of there being no Leon in the carrot, okay, for a member of the Sangha, for example, here at Green Gulch, is then that Leon doesn't fit into the life of what happens in the kitchen for a kitchen person, or doesn't fit into the life of what happens for everybody in the Sangha who eats in the dining room. Leon is separate from them in some way. So the relationship that the Sangha has to Leon is therefore an untrue, distorted, dysfunctional relationship, right? Because it doesn't recognize the fact that Leon is implicated in every breath of every member of the Sangha, because the breath of every member of the Sangha is the result of the food that they eat, which is the result of the compost and like that. So the intimacy of the relationship is lost by this way of thinking of independence of the moment.
In every there's a certain sensation of nausea to sit down at the table and see Leon in the carrots. And Leon again, he's a little bit everything though.
It's overwhelming.
It's so much easier. Yeah, it's totally overwhelming, and that creates nausea. It's like panic, you know, our society's breeding up fear or whatever, you know, and it's easy for me to think that I'm independent.
Right. That's right.
In the short run.
That's right. Because that's the whole way in which you're comfortable, the whole way in which you're trained. And so the reaction to it, I really didn't mean to get you into this thing. We're going to have to go on down this path. The reaction that you described of nausea, I mean, it's nice that you're really grounded in that kind of emotional language. The overwhelmingness, the panic of it, has to do with the fact that our whole sense of what reality is seen as fictional in that moment. And it makes us uncomfortable. And even more significantly than our sense of reality, perhaps, is our sense of who we are. Mm-hmm. Right? Because in our minds, anyhow, we can hold those two as separate, although in fact they usually define each other. And so the overwhelmingness of seeing how all those things come together in the one moment of slicing through the single carrot or taking that bite of carrot in the soup, the overwhelmingness of the complexity of what's going on in that moment and our reaction to it is the gauge of the degree to which we want to maintain our fictional independence. If you read something like the Avatamsaka Sutra or the Lotus Sutra, they describe a world in which the exact opposite is what's perceived in every moment. Because they describe the world from the point of view of the Bodhisattva, in which the overwhelming complexity of interconnectedness and interdependence, although it's described in sort of a narrative, so to
now.
So it takes time to describe it. In fact, basically what the Avatamsaka is attempting to describe is in a single moment the unbelievable interpenetration of everything. So the truth of the fact of the carrot floating in the soup stone, if we were to examine it, is, in fact, the kitchen crew that brought the soup out and put it on the table. I'm just going to do a truncated version. The kitchen crew that brought the soup out and put it on the table, right, that cooked it, that cut it, that brought it out of the garden, that grew it in the garden, that planted it, that weeded it, that provided the compost, and then we get into this, you know, the whole, the sun, the moon, the stars, you know, the wind, the water, the circumstances that brought us to Green Gulch, you know, the Sangha that built Green Gulch, George Wheelwright, who gave the land, I mean, then we get beyond the persons, get into the, you know, the transhuman. In fact, the truth is that in that little piece of carrot floating in the spoon, all of that history exists.
Is that how the experience of now is unfindable? Because when you look for now, you see all of the past.
That's one of the ways. Yeah. At the level of the functional basis, that's true. At the level of the basis beyond the fantasy of a separate thing in a separate moment, that's actually true. That's all there. I mean, one of the experiences I had that really kind of blew me away one day in the kitchen, back to carrots, something about eating carrots. One day I was on fine slicing half moons of carrots, and 2.5 gallons. That took all morning.
For miso soup?
Was it for miso soup? It might have been. It was for soup that was made the next day. Sorry. I missed that. Probably just as well. So 2.5 gallons of carrots, fine sliced, is about, you know, a bucket about this big and about this big around. So at the end of the morning, my arm was sore, and I stood there and I kind of looked at this, and I thought, okay, that was a morning of my life. The energy and the consciousness of a morning of my life in that bucket of carrots. And that seemed like not very much on the one hand, but then the bucket of carrots kind of had this radiance of my life in it, and it seemed like a lot. But then what was that? I mean, that was only one morning in the life of a carrot. The energy of the carrot was weeks and weeks and weeks. As a carrot. Weeks and weeks and weeks. All this energy impacted and concentrated in that bucket. And of course, okay, that turned into miso soup. Well, then, if you sort of expand that image and think about the actual amount of energy that's loaded into every bowl of food that comes your way, it's actually staggering. It's completely almost paralytic when you really contemplate what is in front of you in a bowl of food. All the people who are wrapped into it, all the actual energy that's systemically organized and captured, you know, in that bowl of food is just incredible. And it's almost paralytic. It's almost impossible to eat it. Now, this sounds real abstract, but not necessarily so. When Kay and I were on retreat in Bodh Gaya, she got really sick and couldn't eat anything for, a week or something? About a week? Got dehydrated because she couldn't drink anything. Right? And at the end of that period of time, we got her on IVs and we sort of kept her functioning. And then she finally felt like she could eat something. Right? So what could, so we brought her some cooked lentils. Lentils and broth. Yeah, it was dal. That's what she was seeking for, dal and broth. She said, you know, she got like one lentil in her mouth, and the energy from that one lentil just like filled her body. You know, it's like because she'd been sick and not eating and was sensitized to what's actually there in that one crummy little lentil. Right? But it's always there. It's just that we're not noticing it. Because of this whole programming about what is reality. Well, we're the practice. I mean, think of all the overeating we do in this society. Because we don't eat. We're doing something else. We're not actually eating. We're not actually relating to what that food is. We're doing something else entirely. Okay.
Statement you just heard about. So if we're fully conscious and aware of the almost paralysis that you described was this whole thing on, if you were actually to go ahead and take it into your body and realize that the energy of the mind and body realizing it is far more intense, far more powerful, far more nutritious, far, just by imagination. I know we learned this last time. A trained imagination.
Yeah. Yes, and now the question is, at this point, since you raise this, how much is imagination and how much is not imagination? Because you raised the issue earlier of, well, now here you're talking about completely rewiring, as it were, or repatterning the entire thought forms that you have about how you think about things. And that's actually what I'm talking about. When I talk about this kind of imaginative exercise, I'm talking about using imagination based upon what's philosophically ascertained to be true, using imagination to repattern the whole way one thinks about things, not just so that one can repattern how one thinks about things, so that one can discern what's actually there in the first place that one didn't notice because of erroneous patternings of thoughts. In other words, to use an example that I get from Ramakrishna, now, I don't know if I mentioned this one in this class, but don't worry. No? Okay. This is one of, from my point of view, the classic spiritual teachings of all time. Ramakrishna was an Indian saint, lived in Calcutta for 50 years, died in 1886. And one of his disciples recorded this little comment that he made. He said, if someone were walking through the jungle, and so he means probably like a yogi who's wearing a loin cloth and doesn't even have any sandals. If someone was walking through a jungle and stepped on a thorn, how would they get the thorn out of their foot? Well, you take another thorn, and number two thorn, you dig out number one thorn, and then throw the two away, and walk on. So the thorn in our foot is the misconceptions that we're all completely enslaved by. Okay, that's number one thorn. And number two thorn is the fantasy thoughts that I'm proposing, which root out number one thorn and replace them with reality. Now, the only problem with the metaphor is that in his metaphor, both thorns are thrown away. And from a Buddhist perspective, it's not actually necessary to throw both thorns away, but having correct thoughts can be quite useful. That correct thoughts are a way of discerning things about reality which are too subtle for our minds to be attentive to, even under the best of circumstances. But that's a whole other kind of issue. The basic point I want to make is that the kind of agenda that I'm talking about is an agenda in which one uses fantasy, presumed fantasy, to a conscious fantasy, to root out unconscious fantasy, which is presumed to be reality, so that they can be replaced with actual reality, fantasized reality.
But isn't it just realizing imagination, reality?
Realizing imagination.
I mean, what's, when you say you get reality, I mean, you're using imagination to antidote imagination.
And so how do you get reality out of it?
Yeah,
because
it's like
the imagination that I'm talking about using is based on a philosophical analysis, which is not imagination.
Isn't it also based on being fully aware of your imagination, number one imagination? Isn't that where your training comes in? You're trained or rewired almost. You know, if you do 20 years of training, the imagination that you require to replace the imagination that you used to have is extremely, it's like beyond wholesome or positive or correct or whatever. It's like it's a way that you think, you know, it's a way that you live and breathe. And
well,
you can eat one lentil and feel like you're totally energized.
Well, I don't know that I want to go that far. Because I think as far as I want to go is that one uses the imagination to remove a certain kind of delusion, and that it doesn't have any more function than that. Because in my experience, anyhow, let me put it this way, when I use my imagination about the origin of a carrot on a cutting board in front of me, if I'm successful enough with it, then imagination is no longer necessary. In my experience, the carrot, all this stuff really comes forth from the carrot. It's right there. That my imagination isn't necessary. That really, it's there. And the test for me that it's there is my relationship with Leon changes. That it doesn't just continue in the realm of fantasy and imagination. That it has practical implications in my life and relationship to the world that doesn't require any imaginative activity. Because the fictive barriers that have been removed, at least for some period of time, are removed. But that's the making of Sangha. And that's the point that I'm trying to make, that that's what Sangha comes from. That that's the practical import of things in this community. Because one experiences things like gratitude to the people around one. I mean, now that's a wild concept. You know, gratitude. I mean, the food is on the table, and it's like not just, oh, well, that's nice that the food is on the table, but when you see what's there, then the emotions that arise in relationship to it are quite different. And therefore, the relationship one has, not just with the food, but with the people implicated in the relationship,
I don't know if it's worth going back to this point or not, but I was thinking something similar to what I think Chris was just saying about sort of what is the, is it just imagination, or what is the ground that imagination needs to actually transform your experience? And in Kay's case, it was a week of not eating or drinking, and so, you know, not continuing, just shoving stuff into your body, where you're desensitized to your body, so your body is actually in a state where you are extraordinarily in touch with it. And then that one level had this amazing effect. And I'm thinking, in this case, it's sitting in the zendo, you know, so many hours a day for so many days, so many weeks, that is what develops the ground in which this imagination can actually take root and flower and actually have that kind of effect.
That makes sense to me. Although I'm not proposing that you engage in kind of the same zendo.
But it becomes a
condition for making what you're doing in the condition in the kitchen fruitful. And I think that makes what you do in the zendo fruitful in another kind of way. Now, I have to add that I don't experience these kinds of things I'm talking about as necessarily long-term changes. I don't want you to get the wrong impression about what's going on in my experience. It's not like by practicing in this way, my life has undergone some sort of radical transformation. My relationship with everybody around has changed, and so on and so forth. I'm talking about lots and lots of practice for little blips of opening, you know, little blips of improvement, but that seems to be the circumstance. It's not sort of like some thunder of something happens and suddenly one's relationship with Sophie has changed, or like that. Or that there's been some sort of satori, or awakening, or kensho, or whatever you think they call it, that comes out of it. I'm just talking about what you can do on a daily basis in the conventional way in which you go through the ordinary moments of life to make them practice in a way which is other than the practice of paying attention to what you're doing. And these are not contradictory, by the way. That you have to pay attention to the carrots you're cutting if you want to keep your fingers. Right? You can't stop doing that. But I'm talking about another dimension that can go with it. There's another kind of practice that can go with it. Do you see something there? A question?
Well, I don't know how I'm going to relate it to everything. I wonder when the imagination of the things that you imagine can sort of not be so helpful. Or I don't know what it is to say not be so helpful, but say, for instance, when people say, well, it's okay to throw so and so food out, it's going to the ground, it's going to it's going to all over there, and it's lunch for someone else, but in fact it has been brought to us through innumerable labors, and then we just sort of not use it all, sort of throw it away. Mm-hmm. But we justify that through our imagination of it
reincorporate
someone else's lunch.
I understand exactly what you're saying. You use the word justify,
yeah,
and that sort of encapsulated the problem, which is using the imagination in a way that's not wholesome.
So it's like self-righteous.
Okay, yeah.
Using the imagination.
Yeah, you can, but that's not what I'm advocating. I'm advocating something else. If the imagination is founded in a correct perception of reality, let's see, here I'm saying grounding it in Buddhist philosophy, but in this case, if the imagination is grounded in the correct perception of what's actually going on in the food, then there's no escaping the fact that if you take, you know, twice as much on your plate that you can eat and you throw the other half away, it's what we call wasteful. It doesn't matter that it becomes compost, because you know you weren't laboring in the garden to produce compost. You're laboring in the garden to produce food, which is something other than compost. So, you know, you're making a good point. It can be used that way, but it certainly isn't what I'm advocating.
Do I understand you right, the philosophical system, Buddhism in this case, you would not see as a product of imagination?
No, I don't.
You see it as what, a representation of reality?
No, I don't see it as that either. It's much more complicated than that simple-minded. Excuse me, if I say simple-minded, that sounds insulting. Then that sort of simplistic either-or analysis.
Uh-huh.
It's more complicated than that because it's predicated on an analysis of what means emptiness, which treads a very fine line between either of those extremities, which we haven't gotten into at all. And so far, I haven't said anything about what emptiness is, actually, in this class. Emptiness is something which is not the product of imagination. It is, in fact, what reality is, but not in a way that, unless you know exactly what I'm talking about, but not in any way that I think you've probably been able to conceive of, unless you've actually really labored in the fields of this system. It's very different because it's the whole philosophical system is founded on a concept, emptiness, which is probably the only piece of certitude one can encounter in this life, at least from a Buddhist point of view, the only piece of certitude that one can encounter.
Mm.
I mean, I can say that sort of baldly, but to get to why it is I can make that assertion is a lot.
And that's why it's reality?
And that's why it's reality. It's reality because it's the one thing that is not disprovable. It's the one thing that's quite certain upon which everything can rest.
So when you said try and find the now, isn't that what you're talking about? Because I bet my mind we've never found.
Yeah.
Because it's empty.
Because it's unfindability.
So you have mentioned it.
Yeah, in that sort of way. Yeah. The inability to find it, the lack of its existing as an independent thing, is its emptiness. Right? Because you can't find anything that's knowable except in relationship to something else. Everything that you find is empty of its own apparent nature as itself, and that's a certitude. Because you'll never ever find anything that's not characterized by that statement, including the concept of emptiness. Because here I'm not talking about the concept of emptiness. I'm talking about the functional basis or the ground reality that concept refers to. Because the concept is also dependent upon other concepts. At that level, you're right. It's just another fantasy. But there's a way in which the fantasy can self immolate, if you will, and a reality emerge.
If you look at other systems, they have a reality that is indisputable as well. I mean, one says it's absolutely indisputable that the self exists, if you're a human. It's experienceable, it's not just a concept. It appears in these manifestations, and it's talked about, you know, in terms of mandalas or dreams, which are expressions of it, not the thing itself. But so, I guess I'm asking a question about the nature of man, that he chooses one system and calls that reality rather than another.
Mm-hmm.
And that from that point of view, it seems to be that imagination is all we have.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you can say that. I don't think I happen to agree with it, though. The reason for that is that most systems, whether they're philosophical or psychological or religious, predicate something. I mean, this predication may be based upon such a phenomenon, or it may be based upon some sort of logical construction or revelation or something like that. But there's always a first principle in there someplace, okay, that is defined in a certain way, which is absolutized in a certain way. And as far as I can determine, all of these first principles exist and have their nature as such only in relationship to something else. But they're only knowable in relationship to something else. You talked about the Jungian self, which is only knowable by virtue of its products. And so it's a something, an underlying reality, which is defined as being there and responsible for all these things, even though it's never findable, even though it's never discernible. It's the only way to explain coherently all the stuff that comes up. Well, the explaining coherently all the stuff that comes up is, in fact, imagination. So then you could come to the conclusion, more realistically, that what truly exists is imagination rather than self. And that's what you want to do, is define imagination and self as being the same thing. But I'm talking about something else. I am not talking about a first principle. I'm talking about what happens when you discern that all the features of experience cancel each other out and nothing discernible is left. And I think that's a different matter. See? I do think that that's a different matter. Because if you come to the conclusion that when all these things cancel each other out, something discernible is left, right? Then that discernible something that's left is their independence upon all those things that got canceled out, right? So even that doesn't stand alone. And it depends upon something else, too. So when those two things cancel each other out, and there really isn't anything else left, then there's something that's not self-cancelable. What is it? That's what I'm talking about. And that's not a first principle. It's a whole different... It's something else I'm talking about. So, see, I mean... Hold on a second. I feel strongly about this because, see, the Hindus and the Buddhists hashed this one out over 2,000 years of India. They went back and forth about this one. And what ended up happening, the resolution on this one, was that the Hindus came to the position of finally doing two things. One was name-calling, which was, you guys are nihilists, because there's nothing left over after everything else is canceled out. Okay. And the other was, they incorporated that very truth, and they called it itself. But they said they came to it in a different way. If you look in the Vedas, you see this famous statement, neti, 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 not this, not this, not this, not this, not this. And so, you know, many of the Hindu schools will say, well, you see, all that stuff in Vedanta, that was already in the Vedas, blah, 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 blah. If you actually look at where these statements come from, you find that they don't predate the Buddha. In fact, they postdate the Buddha. That they come out of their lower strata. That the Vedas that are older than the Buddha don't say anything about this at all. Okay. And so what's really happening is you have an Indian zeitgeist where this revelation that we identify as Buddhism actually penetrated the entire culture. Okay? And because of certain sectarian reasons associated with socio-political realities, you have one body of people saying, you guys are nihilists, we got the truth, and our truth happens to be what you're talking about, but we won't accept that. And this is a political issue. You know, this has to do with caste and control of population and resources. It doesn't have anything to do with philosophy, actually. Oops, sorry. That was uncalled for. I was just going to mute that.
It's great.
I had a question. I'm confused about the difference. I mean, there's not a difference between emptiness and dependent co-arising.
There are two different ways of talking about the same thing. Dependent co-arising or dependent arising is a way of talking about the phenomena that are before one and how they could actually be described as functioning in positive terms rather than in negative terms. So that emptiness is like a negative language and dependent arising is a positive language. I'll give a specific. If we say that the paper in the book exists in dependence upon lumberjacks and rain and sun, it's a way of positively stating the nature of what's there. But we could just as easily say that what is here is not separate from the actions of lumberjacks, rain, and sun. That the paper is not other than lumberjacks, rain, and sun. Or we could say that in what would sound like heavily convoluted language, that it's empty of being separate from lumberjacks, rain, and sun. If we said that it's empty from being separate from those things, it would sound like a ridiculous way to talk about that. But if we said it's dependent upon, it's a more sensible way to talk about an object. But at the experiential level, when we are in the ordinary sort of day-to-day going through life of things, we do experience objects, and we do experience, at best, their connections to other things, then that's a good language. The language of dependence, or dependent arising, is a good language to use. But when we're meditating, and we're sitting in the Zendo, that's not such a good language to use, because then what's happening is we're using a language of creating images and creating ideas when what we're attempting to do is pull our minds back away from that. And the language of the experience of emptiness is more suitable. So the language of emptiness, this is like a shorthand, the language of emptiness is the language of one point of meditative experience. And the language of dependent arising is the language of everyday experience of the world. It's the distinctions that are made in Mahayana art. It's called the two truths, conventional truth and the ultimate truth. The conventional truth and the ultimate truth. The conventional truth is the truth of what's going on when we're not sitting with a cushion. Which is to say, if we're great bodhisattvas, that is, that's what's going on when we're not sitting on a cushion. And we're in a world in which everything is interpenetrating everything else. But when we're sitting on a cushion in one point of meditation, and no thoughts are arising, and no images are being attended to, what is it to be experienced that's interconnected with anything else? There's nothing to be experienced interconnected with anything else. So the language of emptiness is the language of how do you relate to any phenomenon that might occur. When the wind blows and the trees rustle, the experience that you have when you're meditating is of no particular phenomenon going on. It's just the sound arises, passes through, and goes away. You don't attach to or grasp anything. The language of emptiness in that framework is more suitable. Philosophically, it's also more suitable. But just as if you really dwell on the profundity of everything that's wrapped up in each piece of carry as it's about to go in your mouth, you'd never finish your lunch. There's a way in which that level of philosophical analysis is not suitable to carrying on daily life any more than for most of us that level of awareness of the interconnectedness of things is not really suitable for getting on with things, because then we can't get on with anything, because the truth then projects us out of our ability to deal with ordinariness. Not that any of us has to worry about that one yet, I don't think. But that's a sort of shortcut about the difference. Maybe I'll try and talk more about them another time. But what I've done this evening is like more focused like on the three moments of time, focused on the past in relationship to the present. I focused on Leon and Akira. Okay. Next time we meet, I want to focus more on the future in relationship to the present. Because one of the points about philosophical aspects of emptiness is that the whole tradition of compassion, compassionate action, altruism, it's called bodhicitta, is also rooted in this this middle way system. In rooted in understanding emptiness, that actually compassionate action is something that it arises out of the profound understanding of emptiness, the dependent arising. And it has to do with the present and the future more than the time, more than the present and the past more than the time. So that's, since we have a limited number of meetings, that's sort of a shift that I want to make to our next meeting. Maybe after that I'll talk more about what means emptiness literally, actually, in this relationship with dependent arising. But I'm talking about everyday emptiness here, not extraordinary.
Not Sunday.
Not Sunday, go to the Zendo emptiness. Let's have one last question before we put down.
I don't know if this is a question, but I have a comment. And I don't know if it's kind of involved, but I really like what you said about that it's interesting that humans tend to pick different philosophical systems and say, oh, this is reality. No, this is reality. Well, I think this is reality. And I noticed that I felt a little worried when I heard your response, like that sort of fundamentalism might be happening here, like you know, that kind of tension when you feel like somebody's picking something and saying, well, I just know this is reality, and I don't really understand why you think this is reality, and maybe I think this over here is more like reality. But I mean, I think it's okay if people have a lot of different realities, it's all right with me. But what I'm interested in this class more is, I like what we were talking about with the carrot and seeing where it comes from and where it goes to. That makes me feel more connected to the rest of the universe. It makes me feel more grateful, a little more gentle, a little less caught up in my own self-importance, and like I could be more understanding of people, and that seems what's important to me. And I feel a little nervous when we start talking about ultimate realities, and I just wanted to bring up that concern and see if anyone else shared that or felt anything similar or opposing or in between.
Well, no one's ever called me a fundamentalist before, but I did come up pretty strong. I can see why you had that reaction. Do you know who Bob Fleming is? Professor of
Columbia?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He once made a comment about not having to be too concerned about this, because he comes up pretty strong about this too also. He said, you know, no one can really imagine a jihad with somebody at the head of it with a sword on a horse leading the troops saying, for emptiness!
Mm-hmm.
I thought, that's probably true. You wouldn't have too many people following you with that particular jihad. I take your part in my humor.
Well, right now there's a monk that I respect very much in Thailand who's been disrobed and is in Thai jails, where the life expectancy is about 5 years because he disagreed with the state Buddhist religion. So there you go, the jihad on this monk I like. Sorry to contradict you, but there wasn't any sword.
I see your point. It doesn't sound to me like we're actually even talking about the same thing, though.
No, I don't think so.
I mean, again, it sounds like what you're talking about is the kind of socio-political humbug that organized religion gets into when it has a stake in a certain discernment of the truth, because there's political and economic values attached to it. Not because there's a concern with an actual discernment of what reality might be. Because nobody gets thrown in jail because it's viewed that their reality is somehow different than my reality, unless their discernment of reality affects my reality in a way which causes me to lose some value, money, property, or any of that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah, you're right. They said it was ideology, but it was political.
That doesn't surprise me. I mean, in Tibet, Buddhist monks were known to, you know, attack and sack each other's monasteries at a certain point in Buddhist history.
Mm-hmm.
And the flag that was waving sometimes is the flag of doctrine. but the reality underlying it was invariably the same thing. It wasn't doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
It had to do with resources.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's always the way it is. And even in modern universities, when people go after each other and deny each other tenure or shunt each other into inopportune circumstances and departments, or people don't get the grants and they get all the schlep work or what have you, it doesn't have to do truly with the fact that people have honestly divergent points of view. It has to do with something else that's involved in universities. It has to do more with ego, pride, vanity. It still doesn't have to do with truth. People who are concerned about truth don't, in my experience, people who are actually concerned about truth don't commit these kind of abominations. Not if they're actually concerned about truth. They're concerned about other things they do. And then we'll talk about a veneer. It covers it over there. I think that was Bob's point about no one can lead a jihad for emptiness. So I want to take the time to talk about this, but I don't want to belittle at all the point that you're making. These kinds of things are serious. But I find it real hard to move in the direction of that spiritual issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry to hear about you.
I just wanted to say that Heather's first comment brought up something that's been very interesting to me, is whether or not there is an ultimate reality or just subjective realities, and how you know ultimate reality if there is one, which, and that's something that I'd be interested in doing in further classes.
Well, I can give you a short answer to that question, which is the reason why I came up with so much fire in regards to the point that you made. Which is that my experience has been that this particular way of engaging with reality by looking at the emptiness of phenomena, sort of disentangling our fantasies from phenomena and examining our fantasies and how they arise. And here I'm not talking about fantasies in a positive, heuristic, practical way. Fantasies in this sort of delusional, imprisoning way. When we really begin to disentangle our fantasies from reality and then attempt to discern what reality is, there seems to be, from a conceptual point of view, nothing whatsoever, which would seem to be somewhat realistic. But fortunately, the experiential in my the experiential base of what remains left over when the entangled fantasies are disentangled and the web is pulled back momentarily from experience. It's usually just a subtler version of entanglement, in all honesty. And then that has to be pulled away. And I'm assuming that it's not just a series of nesting boxes. As things get subtler and subtler and subtler, at some points there's a place where you get into the experience that's left over off that all the entanglements have been stripped away, and there is something that's there, and it's that which is there, which I'm using absolutistic, or if you like, fundamentalist language to refer to, which is that leftover numinosity that no words capture. But in this way of phrasing it, I think it's easy to come to conclusions that I'm talking about something that has the kind of characteristics of like Allah or God or any of these kinds of absolutes, and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something else. I can't really.
Isn't it simply possible that Allah or God, what your conscience is saying, the world speaks to you, and you can't kind of know when you're doing them? Kind of know when you're not doing something wholesome?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think that it starts when you stop hearing those voices.
Yeah, so when you finally get away from this, like, whole superego kind of consciousness that's guiding you, it's like that breakthrough that. So we're talking about this.
Yeah, that's
way, just. I'm saying you're going back to this, like, initial source, or the.
Yeah.
That I thought was the consciousness, and then you go further back.
Yeah. Yeah, because if you heard any voices at all, you haven't gone far enough. If you're hearing any rights and wrongs, you haven't gone far enough. You know. And this is not to say that conscience is not valuable.
This is because you've been talking about positive imagination, right?
Yeah.
Your teacher said, you know,
yeah.
Why not use this one rather than this one?
Yeah.
So
right.
Like
okay, but see that's within the realm of the ordinary world. That's in the realm of ordinary day-to-day life in the world. Here, we're talking about something else. We're talking about something that basically, for us, will happen in the meditation cushion, which we may be able to bring outside of the meditation hall at some point, or may not. But generally speaking, if it happens, it happens when we're in a very intensive state of meditation. And we've been constantly peeling away, peeling away, peeling away, peeling away, 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 away. Not this, not this, not this. Cut it away, no, 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 no. It's a voice, forget it. It's discernible, forget it. It's comprehensible, forget it. You know, I know what it is, forget it. It can't be any of those things, because all of those things are products of our own comprehending mind, or they're products of our own training, of our own linguistic inheritance, of our pre-verbal experience with our parents. You just keep pulling it away, pulling it away, pulling it away, until you get down to something away. You pull that one away too, right? Because the one that's pulling it away is just another construction that's in there, okay? So it's not that either, you know. It's, I think, if you were in a koan class last night, all of those things are what's called setting up an atom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's all setting up. I'm not talking about any atom that can be set up. I'm talking about something else. And for me, that's the place where this fundamentalist fire comes from, if you want to call it that. But I still think that's sort of a different place than fundamentalism makes it sound like. Although God only knows I might have generated. Anything can happen, why not?
Attention, please.